Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, far-right extremism. This week, the January 6th committee turned its attention to the most violent elements of the Capitol mob. Representatives offered evidence linking Trump's inner circle to groups like the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers, whose members have been charged with seditious conspiracy or plotting to overthrow the government. Sam Jackson is an expert on far-right extremism and author of the book Oath Keepers, Patriotism, and the Edge of Violence in a Right-Wing Anti-Government Group. He joined me Thursday morning to help explain the role of these groups on January 6th, what's happened to them since the insurrection, and what kind of threat they continue to pose to our democratic institutions. Sam Jackson, I presume you've been watching these hearings. How much has the committee, do you believe, established a connection between Donald Trump and the most extreme elements of January 6th?
I think we're beginning to learn about some of those connections, perhaps not quite in the level of detail that I'm hoping for, or perhaps that just means that I have more things to look for future hearings. I think what we know is that there are some intermediaries that link Donald Trump with some of these extremist groups like Oath Keepers and Proud Boys. And those intermediaries that I'm thinking of are Michael Flynn, Roger Stone, Sidney Powell, those types of people. But there are a few people who potentially haven't been named. For example, there are reports that the leader of Oath Keepers reached out to a contact to try to put him in touch with Trump on January 6th, and that contact hasn't been named yet. So I think we're beginning to get a sense of what those connections might look like, but some of the details still haven't been explored or at least revealed in a public way.
And what about Roger Stone as part of an encrypted group?
Right. So the committee made reference to this Friends of Stone encrypted chat that seemingly contain members of Oath Keepers, members of Proud Boys, and perhaps some others. And that is one of those things that I really want to know more about. Who all was part of the chat? How many of the people were actually actively contributing to it versus just sort of passively taking in what others were saying? I think that could reveal a lot of really important information about just how strong these connections are.
Now, do you believe the January 6th committee is in fact going to get into more deeply into these kinds of questions?
I actually saw a story from Politico shortly before I started speaking to you that originally the focus of the hearing was supposed to be squarely on extremism, but they changed the script relatively last minute for some of that explosive and enlightening testimony from Cipollone. So I'm not sure if the committee will have time in future hearings to come back to this question of extremism, but perhaps that's something they will explore in more detail in a report or other sorts of final products they develop.
What kinds of questions do you feel still need to be answered regarding the connection between these groups and the attack on the Capitol?
Most of the outstanding questions that I have relate to coordination and planning. So we've learned more and more over the past, 18 months or so, about what kinds of planning happened before January 6th, what exactly the people who ended up invading the Capitol were planning to do on the day, what they thought they would be doing on the day, and how that may or may not have lined up with what they actually did on the day. But some of those details are still a little bit unclear to me. So one of the things that I'm curious about is we know that some of these extremist groups have those ties to the Trump administration through intermediaries. How robust were those ties? How close did they get to talking to Trump's inner circle? Was it they talked to Michael Flynn and Michael Flynn tried to bring them up to someone in Trump's circle and the person in Trump's circle said, no thanks, those are extremists that we don't want to be associated with? Or was it much more direct? Did they get closer to their goal of talking to Trump? That's something that we don't know, or at least I don't know yet. One of the other outstanding questions in my mind is about coordination between the extremist groups. So we've seen a little bit of evidence about attempts. Specifically, there's an Oath Keeper from Florida named Kelly Meggs. In the hearing on Tuesday, we learned about messages that Meggs sent about coordinating with Florida Proud Boys and Florida 3%ers. I'm curious about whether that was part of a larger effort to coordinate between the groups, or if that was more of a one-off thing that just this one person did. I would be really interested in what the committee has learned about those sorts of issues.
What about the two witnesses that the committee had this week, a former Oath Keeper and a, quote, non-extremist Trump supporter? How important did you think it was to include those two perspectives?
It's interesting to think about what purpose having witnesses and hearings like this is meant to serve. So in the case of these two witnesses, I'm not sure that we necessarily learned anything new in terms of what happened or planning or anything like that. But the two witnesses, I thought, did a really good job of putting a human face on some of the things that we already knew. And in particular, the testimony by Mr. Ayers really, really, really made concrete and easy to grasp and understand just how powerful of an effect Donald Trump's tweets even had on January 6th itself. Putting a face to that thing that we know about Trump's influence over these groups, I think, is really helpful in making the committee's larger point about Trump's culpability for the insurrection.
One of the two said he had lost his job, he had lost his home. I didn't understand how that fit in there.
When you're facing federal charges for participating in an insurrection, you know, there might be more legalistic consequences. Maybe you lose your job if you plead guilty to certain types of crimes. I don't know if that was the case in this particular situation. It could also be that private companies decide that they don't want the bad publicity that comes with having an employee who participated.
Now, what were the most interesting bits of information you took away from the testimony of Stephen Ayers?
I think Ayers really demonstrated pretty effectively the power that Trump had to call out supporters and to implicitly or even explicitly control their actions on the day. I believe it was Ayers who talked about only going to Washington, D.C. because the president tweeted about it and called for it and those sorts of things. And one of the things that was so interesting to me is I believe he said something along the lines of, we weren't planning on going to the Capitol, but then the president told us to go to the Capitol during the rally. And then while we were in the Capitol, when Trump finally sent out his tweet urging people to go home, that's when people started talking about the tweet as soon as he sent it, and people started dispersing and going home. That, to me, is a really, really clear and hard to argue with example of Trump's influence over these people.
And those people, I wonder how many of them felt, as Stephen Ayers did, that just the president's call was enough not only to bring him to Washington, but others went further into the Capitol itself. But the others who were at the forefront must have been more devoted members of one of these extremist groups.
I think some of them were. I think members of some of these extremist groups played really important roles in starting some of the more violent action, in spearheading the invasion of the building. But plenty of people who were inside the Capitol had no such affiliation. I saw an estimate that more than 2,000 people are believed to have entered the Capitol building. And I can't imagine that the majority of them had some sort of formal affiliation.
So they just went along with the crowd.
Yeah, I think it's also important, though, to sort of take a step back and think about how we should think about groups like Proud Boys and Oath Keepers. So one thing that I've tried to emphasize to everyone I've talked to in the past year and a half about this is that these extremist groups are helpful to us as long as we treat them as concrete examples of broader phenomena in American politics. It's not just people who are members of formal groups who believe these ideas, who believe that some sort of exception to the normal rules of American politics can be justified, who believe that the Capitol is the people's house and they as taxpayers are entitled to go in it whenever they want and go wherever they want. The group affiliation is important and it's interesting, but there are many more, I would guess, orders of magnitude more people who are unaffiliated but exist within these same milieus and buy into these same ideas than there are people who are formal members of these groups.
And do you think that they were there long before Trump came along and he just was able to grab hold of that sense of dissatisfaction and take it further and further?
Absolutely. I think we can find examples of the ideas that animate some of these actors going back decades, even centuries in American history and American political culture, right? If we want to, we can even think of the war for independence as being driven by perceptions of tyranny and perceptions about what the proper responses to tyranny are. So in a certain sense, perhaps some of these extremists have a point when they say that there's historical precedent for what they're doing. Where I would disagree with them is just because we have historical precedent doesn't mean that your action is morally or politically justifiable, right? We can say that people in the past have carried out insurrections or have changed their government without then necessarily believing that people can do it again in the conditions in which we find ourselves.
I don't know whether you've seen Susan Glasser's most recent piece in The New Yorker, where she talks about the fact that while you think of what happened on January 6th as an aberration, it could, in fact, be the beginnings, the motivation, the impetus behind a true civil war. Do you believe that to be a possibility?
Many things are possible, and I'm bad at forecasting, so I wouldn't want to try to say whether I think it's likely or unlikely. What I'll say instead is, even if we think about just a group like Oath Keepers, which has only been around since 2009, we can see in their history that they are engaging in a range of activities all the time. And a lot of those...
Give me a sense of those activities.
Sure. So what I'm thinking of here specifically is things that are a little bit more confrontational. So setting aside some of the basic organization building activities that a group like Oath Keepers might get involved in, we can look at local issues that they've gotten involved in different places. So one of the early things that Oath Keepers did was they went to a town called Quartzsite in Arizona, and they were part of a demonstration that sort of emerged out of this dispute between the city council, the mayor, and the chief of police. And Oath Keepers were there for a day. They were delivering speeches. They were shoulder to shoulder with Tea Party folks and with right-leaning biker groups and, you know, all sorts of different actors. But this was a pretty localized event, and it did not get a whole lot of attention. So there are localized events like that, but then they're interspersed with much bigger, much more prominent events like the 2014 Bundy Ranch standoff, where several, I believe several dozen Oath Keepers were present. They brought their firearms, they brought their gear, they believed themselves to be participating in a so-called security operation to protect the Bundy family against federal tyranny and a potential use of military assets against the family. So if we think about these two examples of events, they sort of show us the range of different things that the group has been involved in, from relatively small, relatively local, relatively unnoticed, to relatively high profile, to the point where participants in the Bundy Ranch standoff said, "We were one car backfire away from a shootout and a massacre on both sides." So if we try to think about that context, we might think of January 6th as an even more extreme and even larger example of something like the Bundy Ranch standoff, but it's not totally unprecedented for a group like Oath Keepers at the same time.
So between the Bundy Ranch standoff and January 6th, is there any data on how much the Oath Keepers have grown in numbers?
It's really difficult to talk about numbers for Oath Keepers in particular, or really any group like this. So the short answer to your question is, I don't think we know specifics around size or change over time. Since about 2014, the group has claimed 35,000 to 40,000 dues-paying members. Watchdog organizations like the Anti-Defamation League and the Southern Poverty Law Center have estimated no more than a couple thousand members active at any particular moment. And I think we can see that if we look at some of the leaked membership logs that have come out over the past couple of years. Some of those logs contain as many as 40 or 45,000 names, but that's a list of anyone who has ever been a member of Oath Keepers for any period of time. So if Joe Smith signed up back in 2010 for a one-year membership and didn't renew it, he's going to be on that list.
So have there been attempts on the part of Oath Keepers to become part of local political organizations or official parts of those organizations?
To a certain extent, yes, and that's true from the group's founding. At various times since 2009, leaders within Oath Keepers have sort of gestured to this idea that maybe national politics is a bridge too far, and that war, that battle has already been lost. But perhaps, the group suggests, you can have an impact at your local level. And one of the ways that this plays out is with connections to the so-called constitutional sheriffs movement. There's a group called the CSPOA, Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association, led by a former sheriff named Richard Mack. And this organization promotes this idea that county sheriffs are the supreme law enforcement authority within their own jurisdiction, with the power to, let's say, prevent the FBI from executing a federal search warrant within their county. And that group in particular has ties with Oath Keepers. Richard Mack was on their board of directors for a time, and they've sort of cross-promoted one another. So that local law enforcement place is really a place where Oath Keepers has tried to prioritize or tried to encourage both its members and its unaffiliated supporters. This is a place where you can, quote unquote, save America or reclaim our heritage, or, you know, whatever phrase they want to use to describe efforts to prevent the worst case in American politics that they perceive all the time.
That takes me back to the January 6th testimony that we got from Jason Van Tottenhove. Tell me who he is.
So Van Tatenhove is a former Oath Keeper. He met them around the time of the Bundy Ranch standoff. He was working as what he describes as an independent journalist. I don't think it was necessarily he had a employment in that role, but he was, you know, doing what a lot of people do these days, doing their own independent reporting and going to events and writing up their thoughts and posting it various places online. At some point, he says that Oath Keepers offered him a job as their national spokesperson, and I think he says associate editor of their website. And he basically spent a couple of years producing propaganda for the organization. I'm going to forget the dates off the top of my head. I believe Van Tatenhove says that he formally left the group in 2016 and cut his remaining ties by 2018. So I'm not sure that Van Tatenhove would have any ties with the Trump administration, much less with Trump himself. I think he might have gotten out of the game early enough that is not necessarily likely.
On the other hand, he did say that ties between Trump and extremist groups are certainly not over. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, we can certainly see examples of different levels of ties over time. One of the examples that I think of is during one of the innumerable Trump rallies. This probably would have been while he was president. There was a picture of Stuart Rhodes, the president of Oath Keepers, in the front row of a VIP section of a Trump rally. So clearly there's some degree of connection illustrated there. Although again, it's not clear to me exactly what that connection looks like, how close or how durable it is.
What about other top Republicans? Are there any known connections there?
I think a lot of the connections that Oath Keepers have with elected Republicans are at the state and local level rather than the national level, at least in terms of formal connections. We know of a handful of state legislators, for example, who proudly proclaim that they are members of Oath Keepers. There's a guy named John Eastman in Alaska. There's another person whose name is escaping me in the Idaho state legislature who right there in his state legislature website bio says that he's a member of Oath Keepers and the John Birch Society and some other extremist elements. And there are certainly affinities and agreements with various national level elected Republicans, even if there aren't direct ties.
But what about Republican rhetoric in terms of what's happening in this country and the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers and the kind of statements that top-level Republicans are making?
Yeah, I think, once again, that's something that is unfortunately not new in American politics. One of the things that I think of is Newt Gingrich's strategy when he became a leading figure among Republicans in the House, and he changed some of the strategy, right? He said, we don't talk about disagreement. We don't talk about compromise. We are in a battle against Democrats, and we defeat them. And a lot of this language around enemies and conflict and sort of zero-sum politics, I think that directly feeds into the perception by Oath Keepers, by unaffiliated extremists like Mr. Ayers, that politics really is driven by conflict and that we can't compromise, we can't negotiate. It's a battle of good and evil. And if the side that you think is evil is about to take the White House, well, then maybe it makes sense to storm the Capitol, according to that line of thinking.
That's pretty extreme.
Absolutely.
Pretty extreme. Has January 6th had another effect, which is perhaps to drive people away from those organizations, thinking that January 6th provided evidence that, in fact, these groups were too extreme for many people who supported Trump and had simply come to the Capitol expecting him and expecting a rally outside the Capitol. I wonder how many have decided enough is enough.
Yeah, I think we've certainly seen some degree of that. We've seen some people who participated in January 6th in the riot and the insurrection expressing regret for what they did. We've seen some people who have said things like, I didn't realize that this organization I was part of was so extremist and I'm severing ties with the Oath Keepers or whatever the case may be. But investigative journalists have found that some people are new supporters for these extremist groups in the aftermath of January 6th. Some people found, in fact, that people were signing up for memberships for Oath Keepers for the first time after the attack. I think it's difficult for us to know which of those trends is more dominant. Do we see more people leaving or do we see more people joining in the aftermath of J6? We don't really have evidence or data to illuminate that question, I'm afraid.
Even with the 800 or so who have been charged.
Right. Many of them charged with things like obstruction or conspiracy to commit obstruction, right, or trespassing or those types of crimes, yeah.
Now a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Sam Jackson, professor at the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany. So at this point in our history, Sam, do you see a unifying purpose to all of these groups? What do they want? Do they want another civil war? Do they want what the United States has called government to be totally disbanded and start over again? What do they want?
I think it's important to recognize that there are a wide range of ideas and beliefs and even goals that animate those who participated in the insurrection. We can see this on a superficial level just by looking at, you know, we saw Oath Keepers, who I describe as an anti-government group on the far right. We see the Proud Boys there as well, who describe themselves as Western chauvinists, which I guess is like adjacent to racism or maybe a whitewashed form of racism or something like that. We saw QAnon adherents in the mob. We saw sort of rank and file Trump supporters who weren't necessarily obviously advocating any ideology other than pro-Trumpness. And we saw neo-Nazis there as well. I always think of that guy who was wearing an Auschwitz sweatshirt, and all of those pictures were taken of him in the Capitol. And one of the things that was really interesting to me about January 6th, as someone who studies these groups, is a lot of these different segments of the American far right don't get along with one another, or historically haven't gotten along with one another. And on the one hand, some of that comes down to just personalities and infighting, which is common in any type of movement, right? That's not anything specific to the far right. But it's also true that some of these groups, especially the ones that are white supremacists, that are explicitly white supremacists, these are people who organize around some sort of perceived racial identity and some sort of perceived threat to that identity, usually coming from a racial outsider. On the other hand, a group like Oath Keepers, race isn't part of what they organize around. That's not to say that racism isn't present, but they're not organized around a perceived white identity or a perceived threat to that white race. Instead, they are organized around a perception of federal tyranny, governmental tyranny, and a perception that good, so-called good patriotic Americans need to step up and respond and push back against that tyranny. In the past, Oath Keepers has explicitly said even, we're not going to go to certain events because these are white supremacist events and we are not white supremacists. But by January 6th, they were willing to be present there with Proud Boys. They were willing to be in this same crowd that had the guy with the Auschwitz sweatshirt. They were willing to be in the same crowd as the QAnon folks. I think what we saw on January 6th was people who put aside ideological disagreement because they had what they perceived to be a common enemy and a common short-term goal of trying to make Trump, trying to give him a second term in office. So if we think about this ideological diversity within the far right, I think some segments of it have a clearer vision of the future that they want to see than others do. So you can pretty easily identify the future that white supremacists want. They want a return to institutional racism in a more prominent and codified way than we experience now.
What would that mean? What would that mean?
A return to Jim Crow style legal systems, maybe even more, maybe even geographic separation of the races. You can see some white supremacists who have advocated for turning the Pacific Northwest into a white homeland, for example. But sort of regardless of the details, we can see that they would want a future where white people have even more power and racial minorities have even less power, or at least have been removed. For a group like Oath Keepers, though, it's much harder to identify the future that they want. Part of that is because the group engages in what I've referred to as strategic ambiguity. They use these really vague but powerful terms like tyranny and freedom and patriotism, and they don't necessarily fill in the gaps of what those terms mean. They leave it up to their supporters and their members to say, what does it mean to be a patriot? Here's what it means. What does tyranny look like? Here's what tyranny looks like. In part because of that, they don't necessarily identify exactly what they hope America will become. Instead, they make these general comments like, politicians have betrayed the political system created by the founders, and we need to return to that system. You mean the system that had legalized slavery for people of African descent? No, don't call us racist. We're not racist. We want the other parts of the founders' system. So I think what you'll see there is a lot of obfuscation and a lot of ambiguity and not really saying this is the future that we want. Instead, groups like Oath Keepers focus much more on the threats they perceive and the action that they want people to take in response to those threats.
Considering the study that you have been involved in for these many years, where do you see the Oath Keepers going? Do you see greater and more blatant recruitment? Do you see more acts as blatant as the one on January 6th? What do you surmise will be their tactics going forward?
Oh boy, lots to unpack there. So I'll try to start with the most direct answer that I can, and then I'll move into some other points that I think are really important and perhaps even more important than thinking about Oath Keepers as a group. This coming from someone who wrote a book about Oath Keepers, I sometimes tell people that we should perhaps pay a little bit less attention to the groups and think more about the movements that the groups are part of. But now let me answer your question. So currently, 11 members of Oath Keepers are facing charges of seditious conspiracy, and importantly, that includes the president and founder of the group, Stuart Rhodes. As Jason Van Tatenhove said in the hearing on Tuesday, in many ways, Stuart Rhodes is the Oath Keepers. He is written into the group's bylaws as president for life unless he steps down or is found incompetent by the board of directors. Of course, that becomes more complicated when he's sitting in prison like he is now. Initially, when he was arrested, the former or maybe current even, general counsel for the group, a woman named Kelly Sorrell, tweeted that she would serve as interim president while Rhodes was incarcerated. But later when Rhodes found out that he would not be released before his trial, that he would be in pretrial detention up until his trial, Sorrell tweeted again that she would not be serving as interim president. That was too much of a commitment. Someone else who would be announced later would step into that role. As far as I know, we still don't know who has stepped into that role. So we're in this transition period for the group, where the group is in many ways Stuart Rhodes. He's in prison. He's facing up to 20 years in federal prison. What would happen if he were found guilty and spent most or all of those 20 years in federal prison? I'm really not sure. I could see a couple possibilities. He could be turned into more of a martyr figure and revered, and the group could continue its day-to-day operations with others in charge. Perhaps he could find a way to try to stay in charge from prison, the way that, you know, we hear people in drug cartels and things like that do. It's also possible, I suppose, that if he's convicted of seditious conspiracy, that the remaining leaders within Oath Keepers decide that it's strategically important for them to sever ties with him so that they aren't affiliated with someone who's been convicted of seditious conspiracy and try to move on without him. I think any of those are possible, and I have no idea which one is most likely. But, and here's where we get to thinking about the movement. If Oath Keepers as an organization ceased to exist tomorrow, I'm not convinced that that changes the broader landscape of anti-government extremism in the US or the broader far right. Oath Keepers, even if we set aside any sort of skepticism and take them at their word that they had 40-ish thousand dues-paying members, there are millions of Americans who hold similar types of ideas and who are not part of any particular organization or are part of one of a bunch of other different organizations that are very similar to Oath Keepers, just not quite as prominent or as national in scale. I don't see any reason to think that some change in the Oath Keepers organization would affect that broader set of Americans who buy into the same ideas, who are part of other related organizations. And particularly as we see elected Republicans try to whitewash the insurrection and say that it was just tourists or it was no big deal or there was no criminality or it was all the FBI and Antifa in the mobs and it wasn't really Trump supporters. As we see that, I think that just encourages people to double down on the beliefs that led them to participate or support the J6 insurrection. And that's something that seems to be increasing to me rather than decreasing, that attempt to whitewash the insurrection.
So then what do the rest of us who believe that our government is doing its best to maintain a democratic order, what do we do to counter these forces?
That's a really difficult question, and I wish I had a compelling answer. I don't think I do. So one thing that some scholars have tried to do is think about what kinds of messaging campaigns can we develop to reach people before they even begin to hear these ideas, much less believe them, much less take action on them. And actually at American University, there are a number of scholars working on this. In the
Polarization and Extremism Research and Innovation Lab, the Peril Lab, run by Cynthia Miller Idris. Kurt Braddock in the School of Communication at American is working on what he calls disinformation inoculation, this idea that maybe we can expose people to certain types of interventions that make them more able to identify when people are trying to manipulate them, for example. Those are some broad things that perhaps we can do. I'm curious to learn more about inoculation in particular, because I'm not sure what you then inoculate the person from. These interventions aren't necessarily designed narrowly around extremism. They're more like, you should know when someone is trying to manipulate you. But of course, manipulation is just on this broader spectrum of trying to convince people of things, right? So if we inoculate someone from manipulation, how far does that go? Does that mean that any time anyone tries to convince them of anything, they're not going to believe it? I'm waiting on experts like Dr. Braddock and Dr. Miller Idris to help me understand those sorts of things.
But what about social media? What about law enforcement? How do you see that moving against these organizations?
Yeah, I think it's important for me to distinguish between governmental actors and non-governmental actors. I think we should be wary of wanting governmental actors to become too deeply involved in issues like this, because as we've seen in the past, those institutions, those security procedures, those intelligence collecting procedures, you know, they're going to be deployed not just against the people who are willing to commit an insurrection. They're going to become politicized and they're going to become weaponized to use against protesters, against people worried about climate change, against, you know, a whole range of actors. So I think it's really important, and we should want law enforcement to do a good job of investigating these types of actors, but we should want them to be focused on criminality. And ultimately, focusing on criminality is only a very small part of this problem. So that's when perhaps we can turn to non-governmental actors, maybe it's social media companies, maybe it's civic organizations, and we can hope that they will do more. For example, I've long been of the opinion that social media companies should decide X is bad for democracy or is bad for the world. We're not going to let it on our platform. Free speech, absolutism, be damned. You want to spread conspiracy theories that COVID-19 vaccines are filled with nanorobots that are taking over your body or changing your DNA? Not welcome on Twitter. That's going to harm too many people. I think we've seen some social media companies take half steps in that direction over the past few years. Although, as the testimony from the anonymous Twitter employee on Tuesday revealed, there are still real challenges to getting social media companies to do this, not least because they have business interests that perhaps suggest to them engaging in too much moderation might hurt our bottom line, as well as ideological commitments by executives who just believe that throwing more speech at the problem is the solution, which is, I have trouble wrapping my head even around how you could take that argument seriously given the abuse that people experience on social media, but perhaps that's another conversation for another day. Perhaps civic organizations have a role to play in educating people, in calling out extremism. I think it's important that when someone suggests that elections are fraudulent or that there were fabricated votes or manipulated vote counts or whatever, I think it's important that civic organizations have a unified voice in saying this is nonsense, it's unfounded, it has no place in American politics. But again, we see civic organizations that have competing interests and that maybe are wary to call out politicians who would promote those types of conspiracy theories for whatever reason. As I'm talking here, I'm just reminded that I am really not the most optimistic person about the future of this problem for America. It is so deep, it is so pervasive, and it is so baked into our political culture that we almost need like a system change, a wholesale change of we need to stop talking about politics in terms of good versus evil. Of course, to do that, we probably need a broad consensus that democracy is not up for debate and that we're not going to mess with elections and we're not going to gerrymander our way into non-representative government and exclude people from the polling place and et cetera. But yeah, I think that the long-term solution has to be a change in our political culture, how we talk about politics. I think we need to get away from all of these metaphors of violence and battle and war. We need to call out politicians who put out terrible campaign ads like that Eric Greitens ad of not too long ago where he talked about hunting rhinos and there's no bag and tag limit. But this is not something that is easy to do, and there's no one specific actor that we could point to and say, this person has leverage over political culture and they can make the change. I think it's unfortunately one of those things that we just need a groundswell kind of change.
Well, Sam Jackson, thank you so much for being with us today. So informative and so interesting. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That was Sam Jackson, professor at the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany. His book is titled Oath Keepers, Patriotism and the Edge of Violence in a Right-Wing Anti-Government Group. And that's all for today. We welcome your feedback and suggestions. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Adrian Danhauser. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.